Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program, again airing every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first hour from a May 14th book launch and reading at Novel Idea, you'll hear Brian Bartlett launching and reading from his new collection of poems called The Astonishing Room. Following him that evening were Elizabeth Green and Calista Markotich, and each of them were both reading from their own work. This does run a few minutes into the second hour, but I will air it uninterrupted. And in the second hour and following the launch I just mentioned, again from Novel Idea Bookstore, another launch event held this time on June 3rd, and you'll hear John Claytor reading from and launching his new book, Nowhere, and Ian Roy, I hope I'm saying that right, it could be Wah, but I think it's Roy, launching his Astrid Aghast. My usual start of the hour announcement is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So the first of two launches this afternoon, in case you tuned in a few minutes, or a minute or two would be all late when I said it, right at the top of the hour. In this first hour, again, you're going to hear Brian Bartlett reading from and launching his new collection of poems, The Astonishing Room, again. And then you'll also hear local poets, Elizabeth Green and Calista Markotich, each reading from their own work. Again, this was held at Novel Idea Bookstore on May 14th. And let's go ahead and just jump right into it. Here we go.
Welcome to what's going to be an excellent reading. I'm sort of sandwiched between two really wonderful award-winning Frontenac House poets, Calista Markotich and Brian Bartlett. Calista's going to read first, but first I want to thank Novel Idea, Oscar and Joanna and Nicola and the staff, who are so welcoming and who are such a center of our literary life. Thank you very much. And thank all of you for coming. This is a great audience. I can just feel the energy. And I want to acknowledge that we are holding this reading, and we live and work and play on unceded land of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee and Huron-Wendat, and we are grateful. Okay, so Calista Markotich, again, please raise your hand if you can't hear me, because sometimes my son can't hear me, and, you know, we're only about 5 feet away. So Calista Markotich really began writing poetry seriously just a few years ago. She was a very successful teacher and principal and superintendent, and then she started writing poetry, and she never looked back. She's been very successful. Her award-winning poems are found in many Canadian journals and quarterlies and have received Pushcart and National Magazine nominations. She's particularly proud of her chapbook, Edward, finalist in two important 2024 competitions, and her three submissions recently awarded. Well, she submitted three poems to the New Quarterly's occasional verse contest. Her poems were first, third, and honorable mention. That's pretty impressive. her her 2024 collection, Wrap in a Big White Towel, published by Frontenac House, was a finalist in the 2025 Gerald Lampert Memorial First Book Award. She's a contributing editor at Arc Poetry. And, you know, one thing we all have in common is that our covers were designed by our relatives. So Calista's was designed by her granddaughters, you might mean, by her granddaughter. And Brian's was, designed by a brother. And mine was designed by my son, right? Or it's the St. George's Side Garden, in case you're interested. Okay, so please welcome Calista.
Thank you very much. Yes, I was proud of the cover before I even had to expose anything that was inside of it. I decided that I would read the poems that I'm going to read have something all in common. They're all based on a piece of art from in another genre. A couple of them are novels, and one of them is a painting. I'll try to explain them briefly as I go along, but I thought it would make a nice little package of something that has that kind of a similarity. The first one is called Brothers Grimm. So you may know where that came from. And it did come from the fairy tale, the Grimm's fairy tale about Snow White. But there was more to it than that. I had read recently that there was some thought that there were so many dwarves in those fairy tales, the Grimm's and the Andersen, that maybe they were children. They were children who were... maybe and malnutritioned, maybe worked in mines. And of course, the seven dwarfs, they were miners. So I kind of went with that idea for this poem. Brothers Grimm. Brothers, say justice was done, and the queen, a tinkle of mirror in a torrent of shards, and the apple peddler hissed to her doom in a punishing whirl. Say Snow White is asleep. And the page has turned on the root-ripped fissures in the path, and her branch-clawed waistcoat skirt and flying hair intact. And my granddaughter's cheek, a cool tulip petal against my arm. Brothers, it's dwarves she asks about. And I breathe the bedtime clean child fragrance in her hair. And Jacob, Wilhelm, say they were not children working mines, stunted, red-eyed, noses black with soot, you dressed as little adults for your lore. I'll believe you, Brothers Grimm, for how to explain to this child, children in the pitchy earth, longing for sky above black firs, and sunlight sifting through forest glades. And by my side, a sweet, slight weight leans into the soul of me, and a warmth seeps through my ribs. And twilight peaks our bedside rug, the ancient art of warp and weft. Let's not say that childish fingers ply the jeweled strands in age-old tribal ways. And on the footboard hangs a size 4 pale blue bunny robe. From somewhere, small hands learn calluses in warehouse gloom. Don't say, padlocks, close that door. Grimm's, she's 5 and close to sleep. Say, once upon a time. Say, happily ever after. And this, the next one is taken really from two sources, because it was taken from the original Hans Holbein picture of Thomas Cromwell. It was in the Frick Center in New York, and on one side of the fireplace was Thomas Cromwell, and on the other side of the fireplace was Thomas More, and they were both painted by Holbein 500 some years ago. And there's something about that that just wowed me. But at the same time, I was reading the Hilary Mantel trilogy about Thomas Cromwell. And I became completely obsessed with Thomas Cromwell. And I had to write this poem. Thomas Cromwell posing. It is 1533. Lord Cromwell, you sit for Holbein, your face stolid under his brush's kiss. He, the king's own portrait man, can only render what he sees. Nothing in your face portends the tower's pernicious drip, fust, chill, air, the pre-dew's smell of unwashed hands, rimed by salt sweat of prisoners who waited here. Below, on the tower green, tap-tap of a carpenter's mallet, a wooden platform, a plain box. On a sill in clear air, a dove will keen your requiem. Lord Cromwell, I could warn you. Spelled across 5 centuries by scent of oil and slide of palette knife, I could slip in beside you, my jeans an indigo shadow on your bench. I could whisper you your fate. Holbein bends to his pigments, intent on you, your righteous pose, your nose, your chin. But now I see him sense my spirit here, some anachronistic devilment, dark glint, my sunglasses, glimpse of scaly curve, my zipper, serpentine. I see him cross himself with Flemish superstition, and I am exorcised. I cannot tell you of the cell, the scaffold on the green. You shift in your seat. He attends to the texture of matte green linen on the table, the luster of your minky furs. In a moment you will stand and rise towards your end. Soon enough you will know. You should prepare. You have ushered others to the block. You know the blood upon the straw. And the next one is, it's called PTSD in the Epic of Prophets. And you might think it comes from the Bible literature of Jonah, but actually it came from a film that was talking about PTSD. And the idea in the film was that the pervasive trauma often made the sufferer want to go back to the most dangerous moments, you know, the moments they survived, the moments that they felt maybe most alive because of surviving, but the trauma, the behaviors repeat. So it came from that. And not the Jonah of that was swallowed by the whale. PTSD in the Epic of Prophets. In Nineveh, shadow faces loomed and leered while Jonah, whale-punked and glazed with stink, flailed around the marketplace, gabbling gibberish doom. A shadow crowd pulled close by horror, cast taboos against his devils. Shadow mothers dragged their small ones from his lurid lurch and totter. His salt-stuffed senses shunned the scent of Assyrian women, littering him from the rustlings of a mob, stripping him of rags stiff from rime of bile and blood, soaking scabs of slime and seaweed, balming slashes from the sailor's gaffs, burns from the masticating gut of the whale, abrasions from the convulsive belch that hurled him, half-dead, onto pebbly shores near the town of Nineveh. Panicked in the brine, reliving the swallow, retch, and drown, the frothy flow pulling him to blackness when he was Jonah still. Above the marketplace, tattered fringes of the canopies were, in his wild eyes, a gray baleen with undulating bristle. He felt its brushy wave against his face. In watery rush, the alleyways were to him dark, open maws. unnamed the horror that compelled his stumble back to pebbly shores near Nineveh, scant protected by his coil of rag, rust red as seaweed soaked in oxides of the deep. In stark night, he drags himself afloat, lies limp, water as his bier or bed, hair of flotsam hemp like sailor's knots unraveled by the sea, waiting for fate, for a blacker black to rise, waiting for a whale to breach. Okay, and this one, this poem here is the poem that that I got my title from, and it comes from a book that Michael Crummy wrote, The Innocents, and the editor I had, he really liked people to know early on what the poem was about, so he said if it wasn't showing up in the first line or two, put it in the title. So the title of this is Michael Crummy Promotes His Book, The Innocents, at the Kingston Writers' Fest. We were in Salon A, a raft of well-brunched literati, hoping he'd throw us a line. The angst slapped around the room, dark spindrifts rocking us, his novel with the shifting deadweight of taboo. Incest. All the salt in the Newfoundland Sea can't scour or season this. We were afraid he'd slip, undone, and we, he, the orphan children, wash apart. We caught the line he threw. Hand over hand, he hauled us into the tale that had cast its anchor in him. Innocence. The innocents. How he pled their case. How he hauled our raft ashore with all the orphans' cargo. Hunger. Cold. Cod. Seal. A clutch of their dead parents' truisms. I read the book as if to make safe harbor of myself. Three chapters in, I lay the innocents face down on the white, white tile, run a bath, hot, as if to bomb the children, gray with grime, their hands and faces dark from ocean's whip and weather's burn. I wrap in a big white towel, clear a fist-shaped oval on the steamy glass. Through mist, I see my mirrored self. The children wrestle their resources in the pages that I turn. Courage, humor, a few small mercies. Love, like tidal confusions, like the sea. Dangerous, generous, only hope of survival. Page by page, I lift my cargo. A flick of understanding, heartload of compassion, the heft of ink on paper, in which two orphans scrape a harsh, harsh life, the weight of them pressing me deep in a big, soft chair. Mm-hmm. And the last one, and it's short. But the last one is for Cormac McCarthy, but I didn't really like everything that Cormac McCarthy wrote. A lot of it was really harsh, but All the Pretty Horses was kind of not as harsh, and the descriptions of the landscape that his protagonists went through were absolutely gorgeous. But what really struck me and made me want to write this poem was something that was probably said right over there at that desk when I bought the book, because the person said, "Do you know Spanish? Do you read Spanish?" And I said, "No." Like, I wish I did, but I don't. And whoever it was, I can't remember, a gentleman, said, "Well, there's Spanish in here, and there's, like, there's no effort to to translate the Spanish as you're reading. You just have to read right on through it. And it struck me. I thought Cormac McCarthy really thinks that we should love language so much that we should just be bilingual automatically, or trilingual anyway. I wrote it because of the language, and I just will tell you that the last two lines are in Spanish, which I still don't speak. So I'm going to slaughter them, but I'll try to say them anyway. Language lorn for Cormac McCarthy. Rolling into Mexico, we lovers of language, hot for nuance, pharynx, larynx, tongue, lips, at one with the warm, lush ride. Do not dismount us for cacophony barriers. The alphabet does not dissect this copse of willow, cross arroya, climb the butte. One word, tender as a yucca bloom, compelling as bleached bone, is not enough. We've surrendered to the utter pull of inky cordillera, the soft trot of grullo and paint. Imagine our lives as a map laid flat, a panoramic mural without any chronology. In it, under a Mexican sun, look for me. I am on horseback, my rucksack of flour and bones, saying, I have to put it into English, I'm sorry, saying, we are here, saying, thank you for bringing us here. Thank you.
Thank you, that was wonderful.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Elizabeth Green. Elizabeth, you probably know very well. She's a long-time, well-known poet in our community. And she's published 4 books of poetry, most recently, No Ordinary Days, the cover having been done by her son, and a novel called A Season Among Psychics. She has edited and co-edited 6 books, including Women Who Can Fly.
We Who Can Fly, yeah.
We Who Can Fly. Sorry, it's really small. We Who Can Fly. Poems, Essays, and Memories for Adele Wiseman, which won the 1998 Jewish Book Award for Best Scholarship on a Canadian Subject. She taught English at Queen's for many years, where she helped found Women's Studies and originated courses on selected women writers from Julian of Norwich to Bronwyn Wallace, and contemporary Canadian women writers. And it's my pleasure to introduce to Elizabeth.
Thank you very much. Again, thank you. And that was such a good reading. That was a great reading. So I'm going to start, again, raise your hand if you can't hear me. I'm going to start with an elegy for Lindy Mishevsky, who died last February, and I was, she emailed me February 7th saying, I am fine, I hope you are too, and let's meet in the spring for coffee. She died February 9th, so I was shocked, and I reread her cookbook, A Taste of Wintergreen, and then I reread her her book, Walk, Eat, Repeat, which was her pilgrimage on the Camino. And I, you know, I had a doctor's appointment, and the nurse said, you know, what are you reading? And I said, this is what I'm reading. She just died. Anyway, so this is for Lindy. And 2 notes. One is that she adored her grandfather, who lived in Yorkshire in Mithamroyd, and who was a friend of Ted Hughes's family. And that's also Bronte country. So as I wrote this, you know, there are a few references to Northern England, and they're appropriate to her. And the second thing is, there are 3 food descriptions in the second stanza. Those are all taken from A Taste of Wintergreen. Those are her words. And coming toward the end, Spain's landscape on a plate is from Walk, Eat, Repeat. So I've used some of her language.
Okay, for Lindy. And my epigraph is, from childhood we had cherished dreams of becoming authors. That's Charlotte Bronte in her introduction to Wuthering Heights. You had a sonnet lady's golden looks, but energy of a wild child on the moors. You couldn't go fast enough or far enough. 30K your average day on the Camino. Two strides on the ground, and you were home, whether in Barryfield or Australia. Your first book, a cookbook, had a walker's energy, the intimacy of kitchen conversation, muffins stunningly tasty, tiramisu almost unbelievably delicious, Caesar salad, in a word, perfection. You wrote furiously to deadlines, articles, your food column, 5 books in 13 years. Charlotte Bronte would have loved them. You wrote your last book in spite of heart attacks, strokes. You couldn't remember what cupboards held which pans, but you recreated your Camino walk, delightful friends, intense, authentic meals, Spain's landscape on a plate. Your books published and prized, your much-loved daughters married, launched, your lovely home, glowing happiness. Your heart stopped much too young, but you leave us your radiance, your insanely delicious writing. So, this is about a place that no longer exists, but it did when I wrote the poem. It's Blue Roof Farm Revisited. Blue Roof Farm was Kim Ondaatje's, and she thought it was her most artistic creation, although she did other paintings that are now in museums and in homes, but she thought Blue Roof Farm was her masterpiece. And her financial advisor said, you don't really have to worry about your retirement because you'll just sell Blue Roof Farm. Well, she didn't sell Blue Roof Farm, and she was very pinched for money. Someone gave her money to pay a bill. She bought tulips. That was very characteristically Kim. Okay. So I went there maybe 7 years ago with Yvonne Blomer, and this poem came out of that visit. That house will never let her go, says Helen. It hasn't. Kim, 89, bent, silvery, warm brown eyes, light starting to fall through her, leads us to her long, low kitchen, wood floors scuffed from generations of children and Dalmatians, gone now, the house marking their absence with silence. The large south window frames a perfect picture. Towering English walnut, pond, waterfall, red canoe drawn up on land for winter. November bleached stalks and grasses, gardens overgrown, but with the bones of care. Close by, jays bluer than elsewhere. Masked chickadees dip to the feeder. Chipmunks, red-tailed squirrels dart along the lawn, disappear behind stalks of dry, spent flocks. In winter, deer will crowd round the walnut tree, grateful for the food Kim's poured for them. Outside, if you know where to look, you'll find Al Purdy's weeping elm, Roy Cayuca's golden willow, B.P. Nichols' sumacs, Bronwyn's lilacs. Inside, I miss Kim's paintings of factories in winter, of northern hills and brush. They've sold, settled into museums or grander rooms, as if they'd always been there. One enormous oak, not Kim's, remains, spread over the back wall. Further back, small photographs of water drops and ice, soft-eyed does, snow on their noses, bring the outside to an inner hall. Things are different now, says Kim. The weather's different. Something's ending or beginning. I can't tell which. I'm glad for the young people. It will give them chances. In age, Blue Roof, its work not done, drowses and waits. This is the Veils of Isis at the Women's Art Festival. The Veils of Isis was a terrific belly dancing troupe, which was created and choreographed by Kelly Crockett. And here they are dancing at the Women's Art Festival. And my epigraph is, I measure time by how the body sways. And that's Theodore Retke. Enter dancers, veils held close as tents. Well, I should be standing with my back to you, and I'm sort of turning around and unfurling. Veils held close as tents, taking their places on the makeshift stage. Then music, contradiction of plaintive melody and insistent beat. Habibi, veils unfurl, swirl, rose, turquoise, lilac, gold, reveal dancers by turns languorous and athletic, hands flutter, arms snake, shoulders shimmy, feet kick, as if their bodies were instruments playing all the parts at once. Sparkly sequins, jingly coins, bobbing tassels, grace notes to the dance. The initiate can read each gesture like a hieroglyph, but even we, unlettered, understand hands offering unseen flowers or gathering them inward to the heart, head bowed in meditation for an instant, or the steps that image journey and arrival, a flutter of the hand, a lifted foot. In this moment, nothing matters more. Before and after, empty stage, and the parched August sun. This is an old poem. It's called Laundry, and it's a dream poem. I dreamed suddenly everyone was writing about laundry. I saw a whole shelf, maybe 20 books. Joanne Page and P.K. Page had done a slender, perfect volume, Gloses and Sestinas, hung with pink and purple shirts, blue on khaki pants, flowing skirts recalling lunch on patios, talking poetry and aprons also hanging on the line. Each sock, each towel, a page of the symphonies of our lives, a triumph of cleanliness over grime. I saw clothes tumbling in dryers, scrambling round and round like apprentice gymnasts or financiers. As long as there's laundry, our lives are turning, the clothes and cloths we choose to wrap our days. I wake, the other laundry books unread, glean my sheets for dreams, strip them off the bed, time to wash the sleep out, return them clean, slip back another night for other books. I'm going to read one more, which is more serious. And this is my last poem. We are made of... It was inspired by a Tafel Music concert in Toronto pre-pandemic. And it was also inspired by my disgust for Trump's lies, and that was first term, so it's worse now. Okay. This is, we are made of stardust. Truth's a practice, visible in yoga or dance, where every step, every arm extension shows years of training, muscle memory, embodying the body's ancient wisdom, making it live in blood and bone. Master musicians play true in every draw of the bow, touch of the piano, breath into the oboe, so powerful that the violinist's frail frame vibrates with sound that expands through the great hall. When Rembrandt paints his face over and over, young and old, he is painting truth. And maybe even more in writing, where every breath fills every word. The poem is always forming. Eye and ear record. Heart transforms. If words ring true, they'll last undimmed, as Sappho's fragments shine through worn papyrus, as Dante's terza rima etches an other world beyond the page in air and mind. As a tuning fork hits the perfect pitch and the vibrations hang in air beyond mere sound, true words come from deep and travel beyond the writer's life or ear. We are made of stardust, woven in the web of life. Our finger whorls echo, tree rings, galactic spirals. Our lungs, tree crowns upside down, also translate air to energy. Words made of blood, breath, bone, vibrate beyond our knowing. When true, reach out to the vast stars. Thank you. Thank you. And now it's my honor to introduce Brian Bartlett. Again, raise your hand if you can't hear me. Brian doesn't come to Kingston so often. I first met him on Facebook, where I read his little bits of nature writing, and I thought they were wonderful. So I've really discovered two writers through Facebook, and one is Brian, and the other is Richard Wagamese, and they both held up really well when I read them in more depth. So Brian has published 8 books of poetry, many chapbooks. He's edited a lot. He's a lifelong writer. There are really wonderful blurbs on his book, which I won't repeat, but The Astonishing Room is a wonderful book. It time travels through reading and memory and dream, and then goes through birds. It has some of his wonderful nature writing, but it's a world in itself. It's really wonderful. So I think we're privileged to have Brian come and read to us, and please welcome Brian Bartlett.
Thank you very much. It's more people than I realize. Yeah. Thank you for making this a big house. I was here 8 years ago, and when I was here 8 years ago, I just had 2 books of prose out, one book of nature writing and one book about poetry. There are copies of those at the cache. But I'm glad to be here this time to read from poetry. One thing in giving readings is that, you know, you usually meticulously try to find the best order for the poems you've assembled for a collection. And then you pay a lot of attention to what poem follows what poem, so on and so forth. But when you give a reading, of course, you're not going to be able to read the whole collection with this momentum from the first page to the last page. So you can kind of shake things up. And one thing I like to do sometimes is just radically change the order of things. So I'd like to start today with the last poem in the book. You know the expression, are you as tired as I am of the expression, at the end of the day?
Okay.
So that's what inspired this. It's called 11:59 p.m. It was the year when everyone and his dog, cat, and crocodile kept saying, at the end of the day, in one ear, out the other, filler, empty phrase, yet more diurnal than when all is said and done, and lighter than ultimately. The key was to speak the words without thinking them. You could say, at the end of the day, at any hour, and nobody pictured a falling sun or rising moon or heard nighthawks squeaking high overhead, unseen against a dizzying sky. Few wondered if the end meant twilight, or the final moments as p.m. phased into a.m. What if we'd said mechanically, at midnight? Should we point out in the kitchen he meets her eyes, whispers, should we point out they've overstayed their welcome? She sips her wine again and says, it's not worth insulting them at midnight. Finally, we find, living in the great metaphor of human history spanning 24 hours, that we're truly at 11:59 p.m., all too much like a dystopian B-film from the 1950s. taps gone dry, our windows shatter, grayness shrouds us while gorging fires grow closer. At the end of the day, dear family, friends, and strangers, it's late. I'm surprised of placing that at the end of the book. It was one of the last poems written for the book. Is that I had never imagined that I would end a book with the apocalypse. But, you know, surprise. So that one's in the future. Now we're going to go back more than half a century, and I'm going to read a few poems that are kind of 1970-ish. First one is a prose poem, and it's called Decrepit, in quotation marks, the word decrepit. In grade 10, that classmate was a master of indirect implied grins. As his long fingers scratched his chest, his wit sparked. Faced with a sudden death goal against his Bruins or a news photo of a napalm Vietnamese girl, he exclaimed, "Decrepit." He consoled a friend who'd lost a grandmother to an early death. "Sorry, that's really decrepit." He also pinned the word, meaning disgusting, not lousy or tragic, to a stranger winning $1 million in a lottery. I doubt he favored the three syllables to sound sophisticated, or if he did, the verbal tick hid a touch of self-mockery. His decrepits differed from doddering, bedraggled, ramshackle, battle-scarred, long in the tooth, over the hill, superannuated, though sometimes shabby might have worked. Did he savor the word for its sounds, that second syllable jump, the contrast between that accent and the grounding given by crep, with echoes of crept, crypt, pit, decapitate? Half a century after I last heard his voice, a question's itch. For another long-lost friend, does nothing of me remain but a single word? Oh, to be that pared down, a meadow diminished to one flower, a galaxy to one star. Mm. New Year's Eve question. In the 1970s, young poets writing into the night talked of the heart and the mind. They praised blood and veins, comparing the brain to a cage, a cloud, a maze. Long before our 30th birthdays and house hunting, bank loans, children, we dived into Hesse and Kazantzakis, gripped by grand dramas of monk and criminal, mule-spirited scholar and lion-hearted drunk. We stormed through those novels as if heading into a do-or-die choice. From the start, I spared my poems the tricky word heart, spelling it out like cutting off an eagle's wings or making a smoke puff to mimic mystery. At a New Year's party, a friend with red wine splashed on his T-shirt asked, "Would you call yourself Apollonian or Dionysian?" My fence-sitting reply refused either mantle. It all depends. Next morning, I cursed myself for not having grabbed a fork or knife, no Zorba, and easily pegged a Libra. Decades later, my mischievous memory refilms the scene. The mind, too, I answer between bites of cheese, holds grapes, birds, and fire. And the heart can be a crate of lumber or a bowl of keys. I'm anything but tongue-tied. On my solitary homeward climb, a full moon glows through snowy chaos. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of, as Elizabeth mentioned, there are a number of poems in the book that are about the act of reading. There's a some of them are linked by title. There's a reader at 14, a reader at 58, a reader at, you know, different ages and so on. So I'd like to read you the second of those, which is called A Reader at 20, Harriet Irving Library, Fredericton, 1973. The astonishing room was like a heart's chamber. Its red carpets and glowing leather chairs made my friend Bill joke the lobby of Hades, fire rising all around, touching every surface with the fire you find when you need dark and squeeze your eyes against the sun, capillaries tinting your lids. From floor to ceiling, shelves were rivered with wood grain. A pair of long tables stretched like festive spreads for Babel's family, but the only food and drink were books and papers, the only sounds stray coughs, turning pages, pen scratches, imitating mice crisscrossing the shadows. Behind higher chair backs, lips took joy in lips, hands explored nooks, illegal pills slid down throats. In autumn, when classrooms blossomed, that room was a cave scooped from a hill of scarlet leaves. In winter, tall, empty boots relaxed. Egyptian cats, medieval dogs. Blizzard reddened, I doffed my coat, the millions of pages warming my heart, an apple on a spit. A place in time that could become any place in time. The room was the red of Mars, but spruce needles clinging to my pant cuffs belonged to a green and blue planet. At the opening to my third decade, I embraced the impossibility of drinking it all, those billions and trillions of surrounding symbols. So another motif throughout the collection are dream poems. There's about half a dozen of them or so, and I'd like to read a couple of those. The first one is called A Dream of Speech. These are all based on actual memorable dreams that I had. A Dream of Speech. I spoke like an ancient Roman orator, chest pumping air with exact timing, neck muscles taut, lips neither too dry nor too wet. Sweet self-awareness suffused the dream, the pleasure and pride of talking, topics immaterial, with a voice both silk and steel, unknown in my daytime hours. Though I projected words to friends relaxed in armchairs and couches in the candlelight of a rundown rec room, not the vastness of a Senate chamber where elders lounged in togas and sandals, my speech was too masterful to tremble with nerves flickerings, and my smiles drew out the laughter of others with an ease six decades of life had never given me. Awakened, I can't recall a word or the alert face of any friend, only the precision of each syllable I'd shaped with assurance and resonance hardly human. A rare dream, not one to repeat. I don't mind if it remains a mystery, like a lush dessert never tasted again. Where were forgetfulness and stumbling? Like a palate-delighting wine, that lingering sense of being briefly some Caesar, but no power-gorging dispenser of brutal orders, a leader only in eloquence, whose brain, heart, lungs, tongue, and lips communed in perfect unity, clear as sunlight in spring water. And the other dream poem I'd like to read is in memory of the great Canadian poet Don Domanski, who died about 6 months into COVID back 6 years ago. And this was an incredible dream that just it felt like a gift. You know, it felt, you'll see why it felt like a gift. So it was written a year after his death when his posthumous collection had been announced and we were waiting for it to appear. A Dream of a Friend's Book, in memory of Don Domanski. A slim package lifted from the mailbox hints at nothing exotic. Ordinary sand brown, reinforced with string, I tug at and slide free. With a knife, I slip the envelope open. A long-awaited book slips into my hands, a posthumously published collection of poems between green covers, four seasons after the poet's death. Title page in pen ink the color of a blue whale. My name with friend and love. How, I ask, breath indrawn, how? The surprise surpasses those of mind lighting metaphors living in his lines. Near the page's foot, those alliterative D's, familiar, generously looped. I weep with less shock than joy that his going was false report, fiction. He isn't ashes, but lungs, beard, and weakened legs, though he remains in silence and secrecy. His death is a shelter where he puts words together at a moonlit computer on nights when sleep stays out of reach and creatures he praised circulate in the sky above his room of books and icons and fossils. Also a lot of family poems in the book, including a very long, longest poem, an 8-part poem about my father's final year of life. But I'll read a couple of somewhat earlier ones. The first one from about a decade ago. Yeah, the title lets me know it was about a decade ago. Handful of stanzas at 62. On the back of my right hand, a scatter of dark marks, circular, triangular, irregular, on pale skin, slightly vein-ridged. My mother touches them, says, age spots, age spots. Freckles, aren't they freckles? Age spots, she gently insists. She's 86, I'm only 62, so she should know. For that matter, I should know too, but have no clue how long ago the blemishes surfaced, if blemishes is the word. A pair of freckles I've known since teenage years hide under a watch strap in the day. A few on my arm are old casual companions, so I must have figured the back of the hand blots the same and half-consciously connected them to sunlight and tanning, rather than to time with its palette of browns, its random brushstrokes and unsteady hands. Inches away, I check the skin above the fingers holding the pen. Spots on a trout lily stems, deep forested islands in a gulf, bruises on an overripe pear. Stare at yourself long enough and you see foreshadowings of other lives. Will you come back as a lily or a pear? Age spots, my mother repeats. She likely doesn't recall my hands a week, month, or year old, unstained and unwrinkled. She speaks like one surprised to have simply discovered a truth. And a poem written around the same time, sort of connected, you'll see, simply called Brow. The furrows in my daughter's forehead are my furrows. No, they're hers, only resembling mine. She's 15, and I was 46 at her birth, but the ageless creases, there they are, lines of trouble or perplexity, worry lines, grown-ups call them when I was younger than she is, and some uncle or aunt smirk, saying, "He's an old man already," then brush my forehead as if to bring back original smoothness, the brow before shyness, embarrassment, and fear. My daughter's hair isn't mine, nor her nose, eyes, or facial bones. Friends and families note the likenesses to her mother first. Yet the valleys mark us as daughter and father. I guess that's better than no marking at all. And it's no curse but a sign of inheritance, like our laughter at having that common ground among all possible sharings. Fretfulness creates designs like those of horse with plow, turning earth over earth, the track changeable like thought. But even the bond of overthinking is a comforting bond. Keep your dimples in common, your inheritance of blue eyes. Years from now, hospitalized, bedridden, half blind, may I be awake when my daughter kisses my brow. And to come full circle, I will conclude by reading the first poem in the book, right? It's inevitable. So, as I mentioned, a lot of family poems in the book, but this one is not autobiographical, as obviously as the other ones are. A family reading, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912. An iceberg pierced the opulent ship. Yet a mother in third class, trying to keep fears at bay, reads to her children in their cot. A barricade bars the gates to a higher deck, so joining the push of panic in the halls would lead nowhere safer or more hopeful. She opens her wide woolen sweater, pulls it in toward herself, then holds son and daughter as tightly as years ago when they fed at her breast. A distance, muddled alarm screams like a deep-sea banshee as her eyes stay fixed on the book designed with roughly cut edges, each page both entrance and exit, shack and icy woods, oasis and desert. Shivering, the children listen to the climb and dip of their mother's voice. Frog tells Princess, "I don't want your pearls or jewels or fine clothes, but if you love me and let me eat from your plate and sleep upon your bed, I will dive in to fetch your golden ball." The sweater smell recalls the morning the children hugged a living sheep, breathing its ticklish flank. This comforts a little, but they know death slaughters all lambs, so they clasp each other's hands and feel the heat of fear doubled. Ropes of water thicken, a shallow stream crawling across the floor. Open the door, my princess dear, open the door to thy true love. The mother's reading gains volume, her voice turning the creamy page book into a raft. But the children will never learn Frog was once prince and becomes him again. In their faith, he remains a frog, likable, noble. Isolated pleas and the ship's profound groaning make the story harder to hear. Sister and brother all too awake. The water, numbing, searing, tears the book from the mother's hands. Thanks very much.
We wanted to give you a chance to ask any questions. If you have any questions, I know sometimes we have good questions in a group like this. One of my friends who's sitting back there said that she once had a group of people listening to poetry that then asked so many good questions, and she told me later it's because they had a few plants. We didn't have time to have any plants, but if you have any questions, we'd be most happy to entertain them.
Well,
Brian, these poems are written in, at so many different times. Well, they tap into so many different times. Were they written together, or did you collect them later? Hey?
Well, my previous books largely would take like 4 or 5 years to write.
Yeah.
But because I did a lot of prose books, I did like 4 or 5 prose books between this and the previous collection. This one was written over 13, 14 years. And, you know, a lot of us, like when we reach our 60s and 70s,